Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam and I will be talking about wisdom in stories in medicine with Professor of Clinical Medicine at Columbia University, Dr. Rita Sharon.
And we hope to hear some wisdom from her experience, and Christy and I will share some of our stories later on, then we hear from some of our listeners in our house call segment. But first, Christy, we have some research that matters that might be important for our listeners.
Yeah, Adam, we've got some on spinal injections for lower back pain, a very important and relevant topic for so many of our listeners.
About, is your perception of what makes good quality cancer care the reality of what you get?
About AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous, for teenagers or adolescents.
And a little bit about measles, because we read about measles in the paper. Is it something we need to worry about?
Okay, let's do our first one. Now, we know lower back pain is extremely common. And having suffered from some back pain recently, I am such a better doctor, so much more compassionate for the number of people that really suffer from this that is life-changing.
You weren't compassionate before?
I try to be. I thought I was, but not until you really. I am so much more compassionate than I was.
Well, these patients for this research was in the Annals of Internal Medicine had lower back pain and leg pain thought to be due to nerve damage, also called sciatica. And a lot of times people get standard courses of physical therapy, but if it doesn't work, sometimes they go on to have injections of steroids.
And you know, there's a lot of hope for primary care doctors and for patients that these spinal injections would really be a magic answer for people who have ongoing back pain.
And in this particular study, they had 81 people who had had this sciatica for at least a month, and they were given to one of three different treatment groups. In one group, they were given two spinal injections of the steroid prednisone, 2 weeks apart, and the other one, they got this drug called, I'm not quite sure, Etanercept?
Etanercept is how I say it.
Embril is the brand name there, one of these kind of disease-modulating drugs. And then the third group got normal salty water called saline.
And so then they found out, and they had check-ins 1 month later, and what they found was that the patient's back and leg pain was reduced by a similar amount regardless of what they received. So if you just got salt water, or if you got steroid, or if you got this other drug, Etanercept, it was about the same. Your pain scores fell by an average of 1 or 2 points.
And the reality is steroid injections and the Etanercept are certainly more expensive and have more side effects, including suppression of the immune system. So if they don't really help for a condition called sciatica, we probably would not be recommending them as much, certainly as strongly after reading this research as maybe beforehand.
Well, and then the question is, why do the saline injections work? Are they washing out something or increasing blood flow to nerve roots, or is there some placebo effect
yeah,
getting something injected into you? But that's certainly a lot safer when you think about it, and less expensive than some of these other drugs.
Probably can have that saline injected just right in, right into the soft tissue, not go into the spinal column. And certainly we do know that physical therapy, exercise therapy certainly is helpful, and that's probably what we'd be recommending for most of time, and maybe medications if it doesn't work.
Okay, the next one, Adam, is about perceptions of cancer care, perhaps not matching with reality. So this was a study looking to see what influences a woman's perception of her care, how that compares with actual quality in 374 women treated for early stage breast cancer.
Yes, these women were treated in 8 hospitals in New York City, and the just over half of them said that the care they received was excellent. But in the chart review, the researchers said that almost 90% of them actually got good quality care in tune with the medical guidelines, suggesting that these women defined maybe excellent quality as something different than what doctors sometimes think of as excellent quality.
One of the things that really factored in for the women was the process of obtaining care. So if they considered that process of getting care to be excellent, they were more likely to feel like their overall care was excellent, and that access and process and ease of getting the appointment may be a critical piece of it.
Right. How easy they can get those appointments, but also the referrals that they need, the coordination of that care, getting their test results quickly, and what's going to happen next. These are important aspects of care. So I think these women are right. If they weren't getting those things attended to, I think they're correct. They weren't getting quality, excellent care. I wouldn't define that as excellent.
There were also issues that came up in the study about trust and the doctor and the patient relationship. And for African-American women, perceived racism and trust of their doctor was a big part of how they perceive their overall care, as one might imagine. If you didn't trust the doctor, you might not think they're giving you the best care.
Right. Only 39% of the African-American women said they got excellent, compared to 60% of the Caucasian women and 62% of the Hispanics. So I think this is actually profoundly important research. And I think for anyone, male or woman, Christy, if they're going in for getting treatment for cancer care, maybe the providers, we need to encourage our colleagues and ourselves to think more broadly about what it means to be excellent.
Mm-hmm. It really speaks to that doctor-patient relationship and listening to our patients and making it easy to get care, all the things that we care deeply about, Adam. Okay, our next study is about Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous for teenagers who have problems with substance abuse.
I think this is important research because this is one of those topics we don't talk about a lot. We don't talk about it among our friends and colleagues who might have teenagers who are having problems with substance use. And we don't probably talk to our patients enough about this as an issue. And the question of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, there's data that it works well for adults. And this research addresses, does it work for teenagers?
And we know that most of the treatment plans are short-term, that relapse rates are high. So you might bring someone in the hospital and try to help that urgent need. But then if they go out and we don't have support, the risk to relapse is really high.
And so this study looked at almost 127 adolescents. Three quarters were males and a quarter or so were females, teenagers. And they were looked at as they went through AA or Alcoholics Anonymous or NA Narcotics Anonymous and over a year-long period, how did that participation relate to the outcomes of them being substance-free?
Well, the good news is that it made a positive impact. And there was a relationship between the more a teenager went to the meetings, that was associated with a significantly better outcome for substance use. And attending meetings at least once a week or more was really the key cutoff there. There was also a link of having a sponsor, someone who's actually supporting them beyond just attending the meetings.
So getting involved with NA or AA early on, and maybe being it linked. If you have a problem with marijuana abuse, you need to be linked with an NA chapter that deals with marijuana abuse. And the same would be for alcohol. These are important things. And if you know of someone or have someone in your own family that's suffering, this is an option.
Okay, the last research that matters is about measles. It's reached a 15-year high in the year 2011, according to the Center for Disease Control, with 90% of the cases traced to other countries, people coming into our country who haven't been immunized, and children who are not getting immunized.
This is one of those diseases. It is preventable. And in the United States, over 90% of the children are vaccinated for measles, and we want to keep those rates high. With this research tells me, Christy, is the importance of a public health system. You know, when kids go into the schools or when people go to get jobs, to ensure that everyone has the appropriate immunizations, we're counting on that public health system. And if you have someone in your environment who's not been vaccinated, there's risk for contagion.
I cannot agree more. If you haven't gotten your measles vaccine for your children or for yourself, go ahead and get one. You can prevent that. Okay. That concludes the research that matters. We've talked about measles, Alcoholics Anonymous for adolescents.
That spinal injections may not help sciatica, but certainly exercise does.
And perceptions of cancer care.
What it means to be excellent.
That concludes the research that matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Rita Sharon about wisdom in stories and medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Professor of Clinical Medicine and Executive Director of the Program in Narrative Medicine at Columbia University, Dr. Reeder Sharon, about wisdom in stories and medicine.
And Dr. Sharon, welcome to Your Health.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I guess one of the questions that we, Christy and I, are really most interested in is, what led you to want to incorporate narratives or stories from patients into your professional work? I know it's something that we get trained to do as part of our clinical work, but not necessarily our professional work.
Doesn't it seem kind of peculiar?
Absolutely.
That many of us doctors and nurses and social workers thought we could practice without the stories of patients. I mean, when we think back, it seems peculiar.
I'm sorry. I was thinking, I wonder if there was a moment where that hit you, that the importance or a certain story or something that sort of hit you of, wow, this is really important to focus on.
Well, you know, it wasn't until kind of after all the business of medical school and being an intern and a resident, and finally I was in my office, you know, I had my own patients, people who called me their doctor. And I was an internist, so I didn't, you know, do anything but sit and listen. And I realized, oh my gosh, this is what I'm supposed to do. And I realized that these were very, very complicated, contradictory, filled with mystery stories. And I simply did not feel equipped to honor them.
Well, why is that? What was the... Because the medical training is all about taking a history and doing a physical exam. And then if you don't know the answer, you're supposed to go back and get more history. What is it that about the training that didn't provide you with the core to understand that the core might be listening to the story?
Yeah. Persons came into my office. I have a little clinic office in Manhattan. And persons would come in with their sister or their neighbor or their home attendant or their visiting nurse. And it was not just the story of, are you short of breath? Yes, no. Do you have chest pain? Yes, no. But really, the whole predicament. And, I mean, I don't know about your training, but mine kind of didn't give very much richness to how to find and elicit and receive and make sense of the entire account that patients seemed very much wanting to give me. So I kind of had to go out of medicine to get trained in how to listen to stories.
And that's one of the articles titled "Learning to Listen." So it sounds like it was after your training that you really realized that this was a skill that you needed to learn. So where did you go from there?
I went to the English department. I figure they're the ones who you know study what stories are and how they work and how they're told. So I went to my literature teachers and I asked them, could they teach doctors about listening to stories? And they happily, this was at Columbia, they thought it was kind of a intriguing, interesting idea. So something started.
So how does literature in its, I guess, broad manifestation think about storytelling? Maybe there's a good piece of literature that you could use and help us, Christy and I, and our listeners understand what when we're reading a novel, maybe we're not really thinking about, well, what's the story, you know, but that's what it is.
Well, literature departments are not just interested in highfalutin novels. We're really kind of trying to tease apart what is it that happens when one person tells another person that something happened. You see, and whether it's a highfalutin novel or a joke or a newspaper story or a conversation with your neighbor, it's one person telling another person that something happened. And that's the level at which I thought my practice could get better, and maybe my medical students and trainees too, to get kind of down to the very, very basic. What does it take for one human being to listen to a relative stranger and really take in everything that they're trying to convey? Does that make sense?
It does. And two of the things that that jump out at me as you say that, that I hope we'll have time to touch on during the conversation, one is the importance of a patient's story in the context of their life, in the context of what is the actual thing that brought you in for this, or, you know, the bigger picture of what's going on. But also this piece about one person telling another person who tells another person, and how that influences our healthcare structure as we go forward with all the shift work and sign outs and things, and their safety things there. We'll save that piece of it, but for maybe the next segment. But thinking about what is it to actually listen to somebody's story in the context, what did you learn of a key element of how to really listen to someone?
I learned not to interfere. So from a long time ago, I simply asked the patients when they come in, if they're new to me, I'll be your doctor. I need to know a lot about me. Please tell me what you think I should know about your situation. And if I left it at that and did not go into, do you smoke? Do you drink? Do you take pills? Have you had operations? Do you have allergies? You know, all the questions that doctors typically ask. That if I just left it at that, please tell me what you think I should know about your situation. I was gifted with eloquent, salient, pertinent account, not just of the symptom, but of what a change in somebody's health meant, how it was kind of framed by their whole situation. So it was so much more valuable than starting with yes, no answers to my, you know, questions. I never went back.
Does any particular story or stories come to mind? It seems intuitive, but it also, I know from our position as training providers, this is somewhat scary to tell a provider, just ask an open-ended question and let the patient take as long as they may need. But yet it sounds like for you, you learned things very quickly that you might not have learned otherwise.
I remember one woman, I still remember the beautiful emerald blue shade of the sweater she was wearing. And elderly woman, new to me, who said she came in because she no longer had her medicine. And that's why she came to a doctor's visit. And so I asked my question of, tell me what you think I should know of your situation. Had I not asked her that, I would not have learned in my first visit with her that she had recently had a terrible hostile falling out with her sister. She was now alone living in an apartment in Upper Manhattan, and there had been a big fire in her apartment, which gutted all her possessions, including her ample, extensive collection of framed butterflies.
Wow.
Which lined the hallway to her kitchen. She was now without possession, had to move back in with the sister with whom she had had this terrible separation. And she comes to the doctor asking for refill.
It's a refill of her emotional as well as her physical state.
So, of course, she needed her blood pressure medicines, but But it became so critical that I knew right from the beginning that her blood pressure and her heart ailments were now framed in not just one loss, but, I mean, countless.
Well, we're going to need it to... No, go ahead.
That's just an example of something that may have taken a while to find out, if at all, if I had said, do you smoke, do you drink, do you have allergies? And it has shaped our work together since then. That was about a year ago. She's now moved to another place, and she is rebuilding her collection of butterflies.
Hmm. Well, I know when we come back, we're going to need to take a short break, but I think we'd like to pick up not only with how you hear the story, but then how, again, a story, as Christy mentioned, is told again to and again in the medical narrative, because
yes,
we record histories, but and also how ultimately hearing those stories changes us too.
Yes, good.
We're talking with our guest, Dr. Rita Sharon, about wisdom in stories and medicine. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Professor of Clinical Medicine at Columbia University, Dr. Rita Sharon, about wisdom in stories and medicine. And before the break, Dr. Sharon, we were talking about, you were sharing a story with us of this woman and what she had lost in the context of why she came to you for medicines. A beautiful story with some hope in that she was rebuilding that butterfly collection. One of the issues this brings up is, you know, how those stories change as you tell it to us, and then we tell it to the next person, and then that doctor tells it to the next person, of what we know about, you know, using that little method of the telephone tree of how things change. And yet we are further and further designing our systems of care around sign outs and shift work and one person telling the next person. How do you feel like this is implicated, or are there lessons for us about how to do that well?
You know, one of the things that comes to my mind is how we segregate medicine from the rest of life. You know, it would have been kind of silly to ask that question about stories if we were talking about Bible stories or children's stories or even political stories. That stories are made to be told to someone else. And we know, in the words of Art Frank, who's a medical researcher, that stories work on people. Stories work on us. And I'm just pointing out one of the sadnesses of health care, that we tend to treat health care as if it's not connected to the person who comes in seeking health care, but that it's somehow segregated off into some scientific, technical, you know, mumbo-jumbo. So, you know, I think questions about how we report these things, how we write them down, who we tell them to, are critical. You know, I train people to be pretty good writers so that we're able to represent these complex events and conversations strongly. And I always show what I've written to the patient about whom it's written. And they typically add things, you see. So I think, Adam and Christy, you are bringing up really fundamental things about how we even conceive of healthcare. Who's it for, you know? And I would hope that those of you listening on the air can think about ways that you'd like to influence the stories that are told about you within healthcare to make them more accurate and trustworthy and rich. But, you know, it's up to us within the healthcare to figure out how to circulate them, how to make sure they're accurate, how to keep privacy at its premium. You know, that these are stories only for persons who the patient wants to share them with.
Right. You know,
so what big questions?
Well, I can imagine that as we tell the story, it becomes in this story critically important for whatever period of time to say this is a woman in a certain place in a certain time who's experienced a certain loss. And if we didn't include that information, a huge loss, we wouldn't collect that narrative. But I wonder also for you as a provider, what recommendations do you have about using the narrative, this storytelling, to help providers who are hearing these stories every, you know, Christy and I see patients, you know, 10, 20 patients a day at times, and we hear 20 different stories. That's a large burden. How does hearing this narrative in a certain way or writing about it, as you talked about, help providers?
Representing the stories that we hear helps us hear them. So the better we can really capture what is told to us, it seems backwards, the better we hear it to begin with. And also, the better it gets through to us so that we can, it's not a waste of time or a waste of emotion to feel moved or heartened or cheered up or devastated by what a patient might say. It's also the case that we're not the only ones writing. Our patients now typically write back to us so that what we know about one another is really fortified by both what patients say, what doctors say, what patients write, what doctors write. There's ample room for any kind of expression. It doesn't have to be language.
Well, and as you say, many patients and also many physicians and nurses and providers use that element of writing or storytelling or songwriting or something as a way of healing and processing so that we can continue to care for other people or so that we can, as the patient, move to the next phase.
And you know, the reason to think about medicine as part of its culture and not segregated away is that in other settings, stories bind people together. Think about listening to a gospel at church or going to Seder at Passover. Stories bind people together. And healthcare is now so divided that we might let stories help to bind us together.
I do want to be sure we take a moment to understand your program in narrative medicine. Who is it targeted towards, and what are you achieving with that?
I began the program for my students at the Medical School of Columbia. I thought that narrative work, reading, writing, telling, listening, could help them in listening to their patients. It has since widely expanded, because when we offered training in reading and writing and telling and listening to clinicians, we were deluged by doctors, nurses, social workers, chaplains, physical therapists, lawyers, and students from all of those disciplines. So now it goes up and down through the medical center, medical school, nursing school, dental school, school of public health. We give a master's degree on the main campus to graduate students. So there's, and I wonder if you feel it down in North Carolina, there's a hunger for some means to, I don't know what to call it, unite some of our technical scientific wizardry with what others call humanism or humanistic impulses or simply a desire to, you know, to be of service. And this is one way, maybe the reason that people come to us is because this is one way to unite the clinical practice with the more interior reflective practice.
Well, and I think, you know, you've summarized very well that this isn't just about the story in its simplest way. This is the story and the novel of the medicine encounter, yes, in a very complex way that involves science, and it involves, as you write about, professionalism, mm-hmm, and with this goal of providing empowered patients and providers together. I think it's a wonderful allegory, and I think we can only say thank you for what you're doing for our listeners and for our colleagues.
Well, I encourage and invite us all to tell and listen and join in these stories.
Where can they find out information if we have listeners that would like to log on and hear more about your work? Is there a certain location they can?
Google Narrative Medicine, and we'll come up. We're, you know, narrativemedicine.org.
Fantastic. What a great website.
Yeah.
Okay, we've been talking with Dr. Rita Sharon about wisdom and stories in medicine. Thank you so much, Dr. Sharon, for being with us.
Thank you both. Thanks.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
You can send us your own comments at yourhealth@unc.edu, or if you download our application, you can send us by searching on Your Health, all with one word. You can send us a telephone message or an email just with a simple click.
Now we'll take a few questions of our listeners. We've got something about skin peeling on the foot of a child.
About the flu, and maybe it wasn't as bad this year.
A comment about our show on faith and healing.
And mosquitoes. And we are going to have to think about it coming up soon.
Okay, let's take our very first house call.
My 4-year-old has 1 foot with skin peeling on the ball of his foot and his big toe. I just noticed this and found him picking and peeling the skin. Could this be athlete's foot, or is it probably just dry skin?
Well, you know, Christy, when a child is picking and peeling the skin, here's the fancy medical word for it. It's irritating. You know, it's unfortunate, but something occurred there or is occurring.
Right. It's hard to know.
I guess that's the question.
Yeah.
Did it occur, or is it occurring now still?
Right. That is a good question. I'd wonder how long it's been there. It says you just noticed it, and it can be really confusing. I think in adults, we certainly worry a lot about a fungus infection that causes what we call athlete's foot or tinea pedis, but it also could be other things like dry skin or eczema.
And then sometimes you have to always worry about if someone taken some medications recently that could cause a drug reaction, or if they were exposed as a child to something called strep, or that strep throat. Even if they didn't have a lot of symptoms, they can have peeling of their hands and their feet. But common things being commonly, it's probably just some dry skin sometimes.
I would try putting on some Vaseline or Aquaphor or good.
Aquaphor. What's that?
It's fancy Vaseline, basically.
Okay. Fancy Vaseline.
but they sell it in the baby aisle with a blue top made by Eucerin.
We just use Crisco.
Yeah, well, it works too. But put something that's really hydrating or that's protective on that to see if the skin will heal itself. And if not, certainly take him into the doctor.
Or take a picture of it, because it probably won't be there sometimes by the time you go to the doctor.
Well, that's a good point. Okay, let's
listen to our very next house call.
Why didn't the flu ever really make headlines this year? Seems like it was all we were talking about 2 years ago, and now it's gone.
I don't know. Why didn't it make headlines?
I don't know. Why didn't we really get the flu? I keep waiting for it to happen.
It didn't make headlines because it just wasn't, there weren't as many people who had it this year. I mean, there were people who got it seriously. There were lots of deaths, but it wasn't as bad as that. Maybe one of the lighter years in a decade that I've seen. I don't know why, though.
I keep feeling like it's about to hit, but now, I mean, we're really getting into these warm months. It's very unlikely.
I don't think it's gone. I think it's just like on a temporary hiatus.
Yeah, and I think the danger here is that people may not get vaccinated as much next year.
Can we claim credit, though, that we because Christy and I encouraged so many people to get the flu, that everyone got the flu vaccine?
Apparently, you know, we had about similar vaccine rates. About 40% of adults got the vaccine.
Oh, so we can't claim that credit. It wasn't high enough.
Well, and I wish we could claim that, the CDC and the researchers did a better job. job of getting the right pieces into the vaccine this year to make a difference. But apparently no one's claiming credit for being the one to solve the problem. And we're all sort of afraid that, it, you know, it's not gone for good.
Well, and all you need is really in one bad year. And not only do people then now start getting higher amounts, but then also more people die. So we're going to continue to encourage it. And you know what? It's a good thing when there are not as many people with the flu. That's a good thing.
Let's take our next house call question.
I was on my way to church listening to your show about faith and healing, and it really got me thinking about how connected my faith is to my overall health and wellness. Thanks for helping me connect the dots.
Speaking of good things, we like to hear that sometimes. We appreciate hearing from a listener who heard our show and express some of their similar sorts of concerns and similar sorts of positive feelings that we were experiencing, I think, by talking with Rabbi Graber.
And with so many of our shows, Adam, we don't have, whether it's the time or just that we don't have all the answers for sure in medicine, but a chance to reflect a little bit about how healing is intertwined with our faith and how faith is intertwined with our healing. It was important for me as well. So I'm glad to hear that at least one listener
Chrissy,
sparked.
I know that your faith is important to you.
It sure is.
We don't really talk about it, but how does it come into play in terms of thinking about healing in your own situation?
Well, my relationship with God and following Jesus is such a part of who I am and my well-being. And, you know, thinking about appreciating appreciating my health, but also just in dealing with stress and day-to-day life, that foundation, the community and church and all of that is very important. But really that day-to-day renewal of my faith and dedication to that is a big piece of my overall wellness and my desire to take care of my body.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think this is part of what we're hearing from listeners and our patients, that this is an important discussion. I just came back from 2 weeks in Israel, and to see the faith that people have there of different faiths, but how that all comes to play to express one's faith in a way that one brings people together and respects diversity of faith and see that in action, however imperfect, was inspiring to me. So
that's wonderful, Adam.
Thanks for our listener for sharing your comments, and let's listen to our very last house call.
My husband rarely gets bitten by mosquitoes, yet me and my children end up with huge welts from lots of mosquito bites. Why is that?
Oh, I feel like you're writing about me because I am a mosquito magnet.
Well, it's because women are sweeter, Christy. That's why the bugs, that's why I tell my mother all the time, you're just sweeter and have sweeter skin.
But that's what my mom always told me growing up. It's because you're so sweet.
And you just want to say, you want to use one of those four-letter words that's like not a nice word.
Exactly. Like, I'm not that sweet. These bugs need to stop biting.
I don't know what the scientific, and I don't necessarily think it's scientific, why men would get it less. But I do know that there are people whose skin is more sensitive, and when they get bit, they're more likely to have more of a reaction.
And it is true that about 1 in 10 people are more attractive to mosquitoes than others. And apparently it's the female mosquitoes who bite us, those mean female mosquitoes.
Biting females.
Yes, biting females as a process of how they lay their eggs and get what they need. And there's something about our skin that is more attractive to them. But there have been lots of research to try to identify what exactly those things are. All I know, and the data would support this, is that DEET works really well.
DEET.
The mosquito repellents that have that in it work well to keep those mosquitoes away. But it also requires us to wear long sleeve clothing and think about the times of the day where the mosquitoes are more likely to bite.
Or as my mama says, I'm just not going outdoors.
That sounds fine to me too.
Well, that's going to conclude our research that matters. We thank you for sending in your concerns and questions and comments. And please send us anything that you would like us to address on the show at yourhealth@unc.edu.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Reeder Sharon. We hope you join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other health care provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.